23. As Horace entered Miss Reba's gate and approached the lattice door, someone called his name from behind him. It was evening. The windows in the weathered scaling wall were close, pale squares. He paused and looked back. Around an adjacent corner, Snopes's head peered, turkey-like. He stepped into view. He looked up at the house, then both ways along the street. He came along the fence and entered the gate with a wary air. "Well, Judge," he said, "boys will be boys, won't they?" He didn't offer to shake hands. Instead, he bulked above Horace with that air somehow assured and alert at the same time, glancing over his shoulder at the street. "Like I say, never done no man no harm to get out now and then, and what is it now?" Horace said. "What do you want with me?"
"Not now, Judge. I ain't gonna tell this at home. Get that idea clean out of your mind. If us boys started telling what we know, can't none of us get off a train to Jefferson again, eh?"
"You know as well as I do what I'm doing here. What do you want with me?"
Sure, Snopes said. "I know how a fella feels, married and all, and not being sure where his wife is at."
Between jerky glances over his shoulder, he winked at Horace.
"Make your mind easy. It's the same with me, as if the grave knowed it. Only I hate to see a good—"
Horace had gone on toward the door.
"Judge,"
Snopes said in a penetrant undertone. Horace turned.
"Don't stay.
Don't stay.
See her and then leave. It's a sucker place. Place for farm boys. Higher than Monte Carlo. I'll wait out here and I'll show you a place where—"
Horace went on and entered the lattice. 2 hours later, as he sat talking to Miss Reba in her room, while beyond the door, feet and now and then voices came and went in the hall and on the stairs, Minnie entered with a torn scrap of paper and brought it to Horace.
"What's that?" Miss Reba said.
"That big pie-faced man left it for him,"
Minnie said.
"He said for you to come on down there."
"Did you let him in?"
Miss Reba said.
"No'm. He never tried to get in."
"I guess not," Miss Reba said. She grunted. "Do you know him?" she said to Horace.
"Yes. I can't seem to help myself," Horace said. He opened the paper. Torn from a handbill, it bore an address in pencil in a neat, flowing hand.
"He turned up here about 2 weeks ago," Miss Reba said. "Come in looking for two boys and sat around the dining room blowing his head off and feeling the girls' behinds. But if he ever spent a cent, I don't know it. Did he ever give you an order, Minnie?"
"No,"
Minnie said.
"A couple nights later, he was here again. Didn't spend nothing, didn't do nothing but talk. And I says to him, 'Look here, mister. Folks what uses this waiting room has got to get on a train now and then.' So next time he brought a half pint of whiskey with him. I don't mind that, from a good customer. But when a fella like him comes here 3 times, pinching my girls and bringing 1/2 pint of whiskey and ordering 4 Coca-Colas, just a cheap, vulgar man, honey. So I told Minnie not to let him in anymore. And here one afternoon I ain't no more than laid down for a nap when—"
I never did find out what he'd done to Minnie to get in. I know he never gave her nothing. How did he do it, Minnie? He must have showed you something you never seen before. Didn't he?"
Minnie tossed her head.
"He ain't got nothing I wantin' to see. I done seed too many now for my own good."
Minnie's husband had quit her. He didn't approve of Minnie's business. He was a cook in a restaurant, and he took all the clothes and jewelry the white ladies had given Minnie and went off with a waitress in the restaurant.
"He kept on asking and hinting around about that girl," Miss Reba said. "Me telling him to go ask Popeye if he wanted to know right bad. Not telling him nothing except to get out and stay out. See? So this day it's about 2 in the afternoon and I'm asleep and Minnie lets him in and he asks her who's here and she tells him ain't nobody and he goes on upstairs. And Minnie says about that time Popeye comes in. She says she don't know what to do. She's scared not to let him in, and she says she knows if she does and he spatters that big bastard all over the upstairs floor, she knows I'll fire her, and her husband just quit her and all. So, Popeye goes on upstairs on them cat feet of his and comes on your friend on his knees peeping through the keyhole. Minnie says Popeye stood behind him for about a minute with his hat cocked over one eye. She says he took out a cigarette and struck a match on his thumbnail without no noise and lit it. And then she says he reached over and held a match to the back of your friend's neck. And Minnie says she stood there halfway up the stairs and watched them. That fella kneeling there with his face like a pie took out of the oven too soon, and Popeye squirting smoke through his nose and kind of jerking his head at him. Then she come on down. And in about 10 seconds, here he comes down the stairs with both hands on top of his head going whoomp, whoomp, whoomp inside like one of these here big dray horses, and he pawed at the door for about a minute, moaning to himself like the wind in the chimney, Minnie says, until she opened the door and left him out. And that's the last time he's even rung this bell until tonight. Let me see that.
Horace gave her the paper.
"That's a nigger whole house," she said.
"The louse? Minnie, tell him his friend ain't here. Tell him I don't know where he went."
Minnie went out. Miss Reba said,
"I've had all sorts of men in my house, but I got to draw a line somewhere. I had lawyers, too. I had the biggest lawyer in Memphis back there in my dining room, treating my girls. A millionaire. He weighed 280 pounds, and he had his own special bed made and sent down here. It's upstairs right this minute. But all in the way of my business, not theirs. I ain't going to have none of my girls pestered by lawyers without good reason."
"And you don't consider this good reason? That a man is being tried for his life for something he didn't do? You may be guilty right now of harboring a fugitive from justice."
"Then let them come take him. I got nothing to do with it. I had too many police in this house to be scared of them."
She raised the tankard and drank and drew the back of her hand across her mouth.
"I ain't gonna have nothing to do with nothing I don't know about. What Popeye done outside is his business. When he starts killing folks in my house, then I'll take a hand."
"Have you any children?" She looked at him. "I don't mean to pry into your affairs," he said. "I was just thinking about that woman. She'll be on the streets again. And God only knows what will become of that baby."
"Yes," Miss Reba said. "I'm supporting folk in an Arkansas home now. Not mine, though."
She lifted the tankard and looked into it, oscillating it gently. She set it down again.
"It better not been bone at all," she said. "None of them had."
She rose and came toward him, moving heavily, and stood above him with her harsh breath. She put her hand on his head and tilted his face up.
"You ain't lying to me, are you?"
she said, her eyes piercing and intent and sad.
"No, you ain't."
She released him.
"Wait here a minute. I'll see."
She went out. He heard her speak to Minnie in the hall. Then he heard her toil up the stairs. He sat quietly, as she had left him. The room contained a wooden bed, a painted screen, 3 overstuffed chairs, a wall safe. The dressing table was littered with toilet articles tied in pink satin bows. The mantel supported a wax lily beneath a glass bell. Above it, draped in black, the photograph of a meek-looking man with an enormous mustache. On the walls hung a few lithographs of spurious Greek scenes and 1 picture done in tatting. Horace rose and went to the door. Minnie sat in a chair in the dim hall.
"Minnie," he said, "I've got to have a drink. A big one."
He had just finished it when Minnie entered again.
"She say for you to come on up," she said.
He mounted the stairs. Miss Reba waited at the top. She led the way up the hall and opened a door into a dark room.
"You'll have to talk to her in the dark," she said. "She won't have no light."
Light from the hall fell through the door and across the bed.
"This ain't hers," Miss Reba said. "Wouldn't even see in her room at all. I reckon you better humor her until you find out what you want."
They entered. The light fell across the bed, upon a motionless curving ridge of bedclothing, the general tone of the bed unbroken. "She'll smother," Horace thought.
"Honey,"
Miss Reba said. The ridge did not move.
"Here he is, honey. Long as you're all covered up, let's have some light. Then we can close the door."
She turned the light on. "She'll smother," Horace said.
"She'll come out in a minute," Miss Reba said. "Go on. Tell her what you want." "I better stay. But don't mind me. I couldn't have stayed in my business without learning to be deaf and dumb a long time before this. And if I'd ever had any curiosity, I'd have worn it out long ago in this house. Here's a chair."
She turned, but Horace anticipated her and drew up two chairs. He sat down beside the bed, and, talking at the top of the unstirring ridge, he told her what he wanted.
"I just want to know what really happened. You won't commit yourself. I know that you didn't do it. I'll promise before you tell me a thing that you won't have to testify in court unless they are going to hang him without it. I know how you feel. I wouldn't bother you if the man's life were not at stake."
The ridge did not move.
"They're going to hang him for something he never done," Miss Reba said, "and she won't have nothing, nobody. And you with diamonds, and her with that poor little kid. You seen it, didn't you?"
The ridge did not move.
"I know how you feel," Horace said. "You can use a different name. Wear clothes nobody will recognize you in. Glasses." "They ain't gonna catch Popeye, honey," Miss Reba said. "Small as he is. You don't know his name, no way. And if you have to go and tell him in the court, I'll send him word after you leave and he'll go somewheres and send for you. You and him don't want to stay here in Memphis. The lawyer'll take care of you and you won't have to tell nothing, you..."
The ridge moved. Temple flung the covers back and sat up. Her head was tousled, her face puffed, two spots of rouge on her cheekbones, and her mouth painted into a savage Cupid's bow. She stared for an instant at Horace with black antagonism. Then she looked away.
"I want a drink," she said, pulling up the shoulder of her gown. "Lie down," Miss Reba said. "You'll catch cold."
"I want another drink," Temple said.
"Lie down and cover up your nakedness anyway," Miss Reba said, rising. "You already had three since supper."
Temple dragged the gown up again. She looked at Horace.
"You give me a drink, then." "Come on, honey," Miss Reba said, trying to push her down. "Lie down and get covered up and tell him about that business. I'll get you a drink in a minute."
"Let me alone," Temple said, writhing free.
Miss Reba drew the covers about her shoulders.
"Give me a cigarette, then."
"Have you got one?"
she asked Horace.
"I'll get you one in a minute," Miss Reba said. "Will you do what he wants you to do?"
"What?"
Temple said. She looked at Horace with her black, belligerent stare.
"You needn't tell me where you're..."
"He..." Horace said.
"Don't think I'm afraid to tell," Temple said. "I'll tell it anywhere. Don't think I'm afraid. I want a drink."
"You tell him and I'll get you one," Miss Reba said.
Sitting up in the bed, the covers about her shoulders, Temple told him of the night she had spent in the ruined house. From the time she entered the room and tried to wedge the door with the chair until the woman came to the bed and let her out. That was the only part of the whole experience which appeared to have left any impression on her at all. The night which she had spent in comparative inviolation. Now and then, Horace would attempt to get her on ahead to the crime itself, but she would elude him and return to herself sitting on the bed, listening to the men on the porch, or lying in the dark while they entered the room and came to the bed and stood there above her. "Yes, that," she would say. "It just happened. I don't know. I'd been scared so long that I guess I'd just gotten used to being. So I just sat there in those cotton seeds and watched him. I thought it was the rat at first. There were two of them there. One was in the corner looking at me, and the other was in the other corner. I don't know what they lived on, because there wasn't anything there but corn cobs and cotton seeds. Maybe they went to the house to eat. But there wasn't any in the house. I never did hear one in the house. I thought it might have been a rat when I first heard them, but you can feel people in a dark room. Did you know that? You don't have to see them. You can feel them like you can in a car when they begin to look for a good place to stop, you know, park for a while." She went on like that, in one of those bright, chatty monologues which women can carry on when they realize that they have the center of the stage. Suddenly, Horace realized that she was recounting the experience with actual pride, a sort of naive and impersonal vanity, as though she were making it up, looking from him to Miss Reba with quick, darting glances, like a dog driving two cattle along a lane. "And so whenever I breathed, I'd hear those shucks. I don't see how anybody ever sleeps on a bed like that. But maybe you get used to it. Or maybe they're tired at night. Because when I breathed, I could hear them, even when I was just sitting on the bed. I didn't see how it could be just breathing, so I'd sit as still as I could, but I could still hear them. That's because breathing goes down. You think it goes up, but it doesn't. It goes down, you. And I'd hear them getting drunk on the porch. I got to thinking I could see where their heads were leaning back against the wall, and I'd say, 'Now this one's drinking out of the jug, now that one's drinking.' Like the mashed-in place on the pillow after you got up, you know? That was when I got to thinking a funny thing. You know how you do when you're scared. I was looking at my legs, and I'd try to make like I was a boy. I was thinking about if I just was a boy. And then I tried to make myself into one by thinking. You know how you do things like that. Like when you know one problem in class, and when they come to that, you look at him and think right hard, 'Call on me, call on me, call on me.' I think about what they tell children about kissing your elbow, and I tried to. I actually did. I was that scared. And I'd wonder if I could tell when it happened. I mean, before I looked, and I'd think I had, and how I'd go out and show them. You know, I'd strike a match and say, 'Look, see? Let me alone now.' And then I could go back to bed. I'd think how I could go to bed and go to sleep then, because I was sleepy. I was so sleepy I simply couldn't hardly hold my eyes open. So I'd hold my eyes tight shut and say, 'Now I am. I am now.' I'd look at my legs and I'd think about how much I had done for them. I'd think about how many dances I had taken them to. Crazy like that. Because I thought how much I'd done for them and now they'd gotten me into this. So I'd think about praying to be changed into a boy and I would pray. And then I'd sit right still and wait. Then I'd think maybe I couldn't tell it, and I'd get ready to look. Then I'd think maybe it was too soon to look, that if I looked too soon I'd spoil it, and then it wouldn't, sure enough. So I'd count. I said to count 50 at first. Then I thought it was still too soon, and I'd say to count 50 more. Then I'd think if I didn't look at the right time it would be too late. Then I thought about fastening myself up some way. There was a girl went abroad one summer that told me about a kind of iron belt in a museum a king or something used to lock the queen up in when he had to go away, and I thought if I just had that,
That was why I got the raincoat and put it on. The canteen was hanging by it, and I got it, too, and put it in the...
Canteen? Horace said. Why did you do that?
I don't know why I took it. I was just scared to leave it there, I guess. But I was thinking if I just had that French thing, I was thinking maybe it would have long, sharp spikes on it, and he wouldn't know it until too late, and I'd jab it into him. I'd jab it all the way through him, and I'd think about the blood running on me and how I'd say, I guess that'll teach you. I guess you'll let me alone now, I'd say. I didn't know it was going to be just the other way. I want a drink.
I'll get you one in a minute, Miss Reba said. Go on and tell him.
Oh, yes. This was something else funny I did.
She told about lying in the darkness with Gowan snoring beside her, listening to the shucks and hearing the darkness full of movement, feeling Popeye approaching. She could hear the blood in her veins and the little muscles at the corners of her eyes cracking faintly wider and wider, and she could feel her nostrils going alternately cool and warm. Then he was standing over, and she was saying, "Come on, touch me, touch me. You're a coward if you don't. Coward, coward."
I wanted to go to sleep, you see, and he just kept on standing there. I thought if he'd just go on and get it over with, I could go to sleep. So I'd say, "You're a coward if you don't. You're a coward if you don't." And I could feel my mouth getting fixed to scream and that little hot ball inside you that screams. Then it touched me. That nasty little cold hand fiddling around inside the coat where I was naked. It was like alive ice. And my skin started jumping away from it like those little flying fish in front of a boat. It was like my skin knew which way it was going to go before it started moving, and my skin would keep on jerking just ahead of it, like there wouldn't be anything there when the hand got there. Then it got down to where my insides began, and I hadn't eaten since yesterday at dinner, and my insides started bubbling and going on. And the shucks began to make so much noise it was like laughing. I'd think they were laughing at me because all the time his hand was going inside the top of my knickers and I hadn't changed into a boy yet. That was the funny thing, because I wasn't breathing then. I hadn't breathed in a long time, so I thought I was dead. Then I did a funny thing. I could see myself in the coffin. I looked sweet, you know, all in white. I had on a veil like a bride, and I was crying because I was dead or looked sweet or something. No, it was because they had put shucks in the coffin. I was crying because they had put shucks in the coffin where I was dead. But all the time I could feel my nose going cold and hot and cold and hot, and I could see all the people sitting around the coffin saying, "Don't she look sweet? Don't she look sweet?" But I kept on saying, "Coward, coward, touch me, coward." I got mad because he was so long doing it. I'd talk to him. I'd say, "Do you think I'm going to lie here all night just waiting on you?" Say, "Let me tell you what I'll do," I'd say, and I'd lie there with the shucks laughing at me and me jerking away in front of his hand, and I'd think what I'd say to him. I'd talk to him like the teacher does in school, and then I was a teacher in school, and it was a little black thing like a nigger boy, kind of, and I was the teacher, because I'd say, "How old am I?" And I'd say, "I'm 45 years old. I had iron gray hair and spectacles, and I was all big up here like women get. I had on a gray tailored suit, and I never could wear gray. And I was telling it what I'd do, and it kind of drawing up and drawing up like it could already see the switch. Then I said, "That won't do. I ought to be a man. So I was an old man with a long white beard. And then the little black man got littler and littler, and I was saying, now, you see now, I'm a man now. Then I thought about being a man, and as soon as I thought it, it happened. It made a kind of plopping sound, like blowing a little rubber tube wrong side outward. It felt cold, like the inside of your mouth when you hold it open. I could feel it, and I lay right still to keep from laughing about how surprised he was going to be. I could feel the jerking going on inside my knickers ahead of his hand, and me lying there trying not to laugh about how surprised and mad he was going to be in about a minute. Then all of a sudden, I went to sleep. I couldn't even stay awake until his hand got there. I just went to sleep. I couldn't even feel myself jerking in front of his hand, but I could hear the shucks. I didn't wake up until that woman came and took me down to the crib.
As he was leaving the house, Miss Reba said,
I wish you'd get her down there and not let her come back. I'd find her folks myself if I knowed how to go about it, but you know how. She'll be dead or in the asylum in a year, way him and her go on up there in that room. There's something funny about it that I ain't found out about yet. Maybe it's her. She wasn't born for this kind of life. You have to be born for this like you have to be born a butcher or a barber, I guess. Wouldn't anybody be either of them just for money or fun?
Better for her if she were dead tonight, Horace thought, walking on. For me, too. He thought of her. Popeye, the woman, the child, Goodwin, all put into a single chamber, bare, lethal, immediate, and profound, a single blotting instant between the indignation and the surprise. And I, too, thinking how that were the only solution, removed, cauterized out of the old and tragic flank of the world. And I, too, now that we're all isolated, thinking of a gentle dark wind blowing in the long corridors of sleep, of lying beneath a low, cozy roof under the long sound of the rain. The evil, the injustice, the tears. In an alley mouth, two figures stood, face to face, not touching, the man speaking in a low tone, unprintable epithet after epithet in a caressing whisper. The woman motionless before him as though an amusing swoon of voluptuous ecstasy. Perhaps it is upon the instant that we realize, admit, that there is a logical pattern to evil, that we die, he thought, thinking of the expression he had once seen in the eyes of a dead child, and of other dead. The cooling indignation, the shocked despair fading, leaving two empty globes in which the motionless world lurked profoundly in miniature. He did not even return to his hotel. He went to the station. He could get a train at midnight. He had a cup of coffee and wished immediately that he had not, for it lay in a hot ball on his stomach. 3 hours later, when he got off at Jefferson, it was still there, unassimilated. He walked to town and crossed the deserted square. He thought of the other morning when he had crossed it. It was as though there had not been any elapsed time between. The same gesture of the lighted clock face, the same vulture-like shadows in the doorways. It might be the same morning, and he had merely crossed the square, about-faced, and was returning, all between a dream filled with all the nightmare shapes it had taken him 43 years to invent, concentrated in a hot, hard lump in his stomach. Suddenly he was walking fast, the coffee jolting like a hot, heavy rock inside him. He walked quietly up the drive, beginning to smell the honeysuckle from the fence. The house was dark, still, as though it were marooned in space by the ebb of all time. The insects had fallen to a low, monotonous pitch, everywhere, nowhere, spent, as though the sound were the chemical agony of a world left stark and dying above the tide edge of the fluid in which it lived and breathed. The moon stood overhead, but without light. The earth lay beneath, without darkness. He opened the door and felt his way into the room, into the light. The voice of the night, insects, whatever it was, had followed him into the house. He knew suddenly that it was the friction of the earth on its axis, approaching that moment when it must decide to turn on or to remain forever still. A motionless ball in cooling space, across which a thick smell of honeysuckle writhed like cold smoke. He found the light and turned it on. The photograph sat on the dresser. He took it up, holding it in his hands. Enclosed by the narrow imprint of the missing frame, little Belle's face dreamed with that quality of sweet chiaroscuro. Communicated to the cardboard by some quality of the light, or perhaps by some infinitesimal movement of his hands, his own breathing, the face appeared to breathe in his palms in a shallow bath of highlight beneath the slow, smoke-like tongues of invisible honeysuckle. Almost palpable enough to be seen, the scent filled the room, and the small face seemed to swoon in a voluptuous languor, blurring still more, fading, leaving upon his eye a soft and fading aftermath of invitation and voluptuous promise and secret affirmation like a scent itself. Then he knew what that sensation in his stomach meant. He put the photograph down hurriedly and went to the bathroom. He opened the door running and fumbled at the light. But he had not time to find it, and he gave over and plunged forward and struck the lavatory and leaned upon his braced arms, while the shucks set up a terrific uproar beneath her thighs. Lying with her head lifted slightly, her chin depressed like a figure lifted down from a crucifix, she watched something black and furious go roaring out of her pale body. She was bound naked on her back on a flat car, moving at speed through a black tunnel, the blackness streaming in rigid threads overhead, a roar of iron wheels in her ears. The car shot bodily from the tunnel in a long upward slant, the darkness overhead now shredded with parallel attenuations of living fire, toward a crescendo like a held breath. An interval in which she would swing faintly and lazily in nothingness, filled with pale myriad points of light. Far beneath her, she could hear the faint, furious uproar of the shocks.